Welcome to The Afterglow. The Afterglow podcast gives women, we're talking to you, the permission and tools to live life according to your own rules.
Yes, this is a platform to educate and empower women identifying humans through intriguing conversations with courageous Canadian women who are breaking down limiting beliefs and outdated rules. These women have done it, are doing it, or can provide tools for you to do the same.
We are Julie Watson
and Liz Doyle-Hermer.
And we started Afterglow, our yoga studio, after years of staying home to raise kids. Now, as podcasters, we want to help others do the same. Step into your own power. It's time to shake things up and get real about who you are and what you want.
The Afterglow is your next act. It's what came after you did what you were told and instead decided to do what was in your heart. It's how you have reinvented yourself. It's your vision for the next 40 to 50 years. It's when you took your power back. Welcome to The Afterglow. Now, it's very possible that you have not heard about the Canadian Centre for Gender and Sexual Diversity, the CCGSD. And the truth is, neither had we. But when we came across the new executive director, Debbie Owusu-Achia, we knew we had to have her on our show. Debbie is a Black feminist with over 8 years of local and international advocacy experience in a variety of roles, ranging from programming and counseling to policy analysis and project management. She's a Black, cisgender, queer woman, an avid rugby player and fan, and she draws heavily from Black feminist theory to pay homage to Black lesbian activists who have been trailblazers in social justice organizing. She was also the recipient of a Femi Award for her feminist and youth leadership in the Ottawa-Gatineau region in 2017. This is absolutely the podcast to listen to if you'd like to learn how to be a better ally to 2S LGBTQ plus communities. It's also the perfect podcast to celebrate Pride. In fact, make sure you listen to the end where Debbie shares what Pride means to her. We're sure it's a way of looking at Pride that each one of us will want to belong to.
So, well, welcome to The Afterglow.
Thank you.
We're so thrilled that you are joining us from Ottawa. As you know, that's both our hometowns. Liz and I grew up there. But you grew up, or you were actually rather born in Ghana.
No, I was actually born in the Toronto area.
Oh, you were born in the Toronto area.
Yeah, I was born in Malton.
That's a good clarification.
Yes, but obviously very, very proud of my Ghanaian heritage. So it's easy for folks to assume so, but no, I grew up in a very tight-knit, relatively, it's small, but I think it's a huge diaspora group in the Toronto area. So I grew up with learning the language, all the cultural practices, ceremony. So
oh, wow.
Yeah.
So your parents were both, are they both from Ghana then?
Yeah, both, they both parents? Are, yeah.
Yeah. So I imagine, so even though you were born in Toronto, we imagine that that must have had or some kind of impact on you. Being, you know, raised by immigrants with their cultural traditions. And so do you have any idea or awareness of how that cultural upbringing might have impacted you?
Yeah, absolutely. I like to say that I'm very, very, very fortunate to have been raised by immigrants and immigrants who have not shied from trying their best to ensure that their children who are Canadian are still raised with the values that our culture has. Of course, it does come with some clashes because at the end of the day, even though we have this diaspora group where it's like a little Ghana, outside of it, your kids are navigating broader like Western Canadian society. And I think that lens has informed a lot of like who I am and what I bring, especially to my advocacy and activism, because I often like to say that I have my feet in both places where I'm informed on, like culturally what's super important for us, values on collectivity. And it's those particular values I try to bring in like leftist political spaces because it's so easy for individualism to take over or selfishness and to have been raised in a culture where you are, yes, you are an individual, but you are also reflective of your community. I think that's been really important for me and especially for my feminism. And so it's definitely made me who I am. I will say it's not easy, especially as an adult now, because parents still have expectations. I should be married and with kids by now, and that's not the case. So yeah, other than that, I do think it's made me very, very strong-willed and has informed my activism for sure.
It's interesting that you talk about, you know, your strong identity. It seems like you really do have this sort of really self-assured, strong identity within you. And I'm wondering about how you garnered that without particular role models necessarily in whatever group or area you had your foot tapped into. So who were your role models if you were potentially not able to really identify with anyone who was like you?
I like that question a lot. And it's a question that we have, especially in like queer spaces, about mentorship and role models. And I kind of like to use the term, and I know Laverne Cox, who's an African-American trans activist, she definitely leaned on to this term called possibility models as opposed to role models. And possibility models are just people who might not be the ones who are directly mentoring you, but they give you an example of what you can have in the future. And so for me, I may not have like a direct role model, but I often go back to my best friend growing up. Her name's Vanessa. Her mom is a Latina feminist lesbian from El Salvador. And she would take us to the Dyke March in Toronto, which actually recently just happened this past weekend. And it was an opportunity for me not only to see older feminist queer women and lesbians, but it was specifically an opportunity for me to see queer feminist lesbians who look like me. At the time, I always was just like, I guess I'm like the only queer Black person or Black girl. And she was involved, my friend's mom, with the Toronto Rape Crisis Center, which is also an advocacy unit for women of color in the Toronto area. And they had the Dyke Brunch, and it was lesbians from Jamaica, like Latina lesbians from all over Latin America. And I got to see what I could have in the future. And she was a mom too. So there was not this, I got to see a parent have a family and build family in a unique way. And so that definitely for me was an opportunity to see what possibilities were there in my future. And I still to this day talk about it because it's, I think it changed my life.
Wow. What a blessing to have had someone like that in your early upbringing, right? To just show you, you know, what, as you said, what is possible, the positive things that are possible for you. And you hinted at your parents and, you know, maybe perhaps, and correct me if I'm wrong, but a bit of their traditionality in terms of, you know, you should be married with kids by now. And so I'm wondering, was it ever difficult for you being queer in your family? Was there any time where that was a challenge for you?
So I see this as uniquely my family, but I think other Ghanaians will have examples of like what they'll allow their parents into. And so for me, people ask like, oh, have you ever had like, did you ever come out? And I never had a coming out experience. I usually say just came into my queerness. And it's one of these things where I think my parents know, it's just that they don't want to acknowledge it. For my mom in particular, like I'm the only girl in our family. I have two brothers and our ethnic group is matrilineal. So everything passes through the mother's line. So property, chieftaincies ascend through the mother's line. And as the only daughter, there's, even though we're not in Ghana, there's still this level of symbolism and importance for girls. And I feel like a lot of that is weighted on me. So there is this expectation that I have to have grandchildren for them with a husband, because that those children, and I'm probably not explaining this the right way, so some people are going to be like, this is harsh. Like the children I have are the ones that are really considered to be part of the family as per the matrilineal line, because my brothers are essentially marrying into the family of whomever they married to marry. So there is this expectation of marrying the right, usually Ghanaian guy who is educated, so that everyone else can be happy for you, not necessarily your own happiness. And I've always been rebellious, always, and not in a bad way. Like I'm rebellious, was still an honor roll student, captain of the rugby team, but I always push back on these expectations of what I was supposed to be as a young girl. So my mother and I would fight, I remember, all the time. She wanted me in the kitchen with her cooking, and I always wanted to just sit and watch sports with my dad. She would always say things like, you don't know how to cook, what man's going to want to marry you? And I'm like, I don't care. Like, teach boys how to cook. And that's still carried with me. I'm sitting here with like a nose ring, and even at 29 years old, when my parents see it, they're always just like, take it off. And I'm like, that is not a decision you can make.
You're strong.
Yeah, thank you. And Even with all of the accomplishments that I have, I feel like it'll still never, it matters to them, but it's still not enough unless there's the marriage to a man with kids. Mm-hmm. And as I'm approaching 30, there's, I think, a sense of urgency on their side. And their assumptions or inklings of my sexuality too, or what they do know but don't want to acknowledge, I think they're definitely, my mom in particular, are confronted by that. And I don't know what it really means for them. I mean, we still argue all the time because I feel like there's that still level of control my mom wants. Like, she still wishes I was in the Toronto area. She's mm-hmm. like, okay, you're done school now, come back. And I'm like, I actually moved here for a career, not just for school. I would have just wanted to.
And you have an amazing career. You've got a great job.
Thank you. Thank you. And yes, funny, still not enough because I'm not dating a guy. And she's tried, I think, at least 5 times to hook me up with guys.
Yeah.
She's sent my, like, recently would send my phone number and my picture to someone on WhatsApp being like, I sent your photo and number to this guy, he'll call you. And I'm just like,
yeah.
And it always ends the same way of me just ignoring him. But
yeah.
It's always, so interesting. Like, this whole idea of you being this really strong person, but continuously having these sort of, you know, limitations and specific beliefs and traditions put upon you. And I mean, we all struggle with that, with society doing that to us, particularly as women. And I know Black women, women of color, have it, you know, even harder that way. But so how on earth and where does that come from for you? Like, deep within you, or, you know, did you read a book one day or a quote? Like, where does that come from you to stay true to who you really are? Because that's one thing that this podcast is about women finding their truth, mm-hmm. because we've all been taught and pulled away, or actually pushed away from our own inner truth. So where, how do you have that? How do you have that at 29, 30 years old?
Question. I think a lot of it comes from the fact that I've kind of given up on this idea of having to fit expectations of me, because they've never worked. Mm-hmm. I go back to, like, me being a child, and like, I have natural hair now, but before I never did. I always felt like I had to fit a particular beauty standard at, like, 7 years old, and with, like, particularly, like, young white girls, and, you know, straightening my hair, and it would always frizz up, or it just wasn't perfect. From beauty standards, it never worked. Even growing up, trying to dress a particular way because I wanted to fit a particular gaze, because maybe I wanted people to have crushes on me, it never worked. And so for me, I think growing up, I just realized that trying to fit into other people's expectations or the status quo, I can try and try, because it does mean something for some people, proximity to power, acceptance, etc. But the standards are unachievable in some cases for me. So the only ones that I can create are the ones for myself. And this is where I get the most, like, the most happiness. I'm less anxious, and I feel so centered in who I am, because I'm creating those expectations for myself. And I think as a result of it, other people who are around me kind of, like, they draw energy from that, because there is this level of confidence that I have. Not that I don't care, but it's like, it doesn't matter type of attitude towards fitting into people's expectations. And for me, my happiness is a priority, and my happiness comes from setting those standards for myself. And it's just something that I've carried with me from a kid till now. And it's worked so far. So I really like it. It's just, my happiness is important.
That's beautiful. Like, I love your way of seeing that, because it's really what I hear you saying is you're talking about the freedom that comes from not being able to conform successfully to society's expectations, right? And I know, just speaking personally for myself, like, I am of a thin build, so it's been easy for me to conform to this idea that women's bodies should be thin, right? But that, I'm starting to see that as a jail, right? When all your energy goes into looking and being a certain size or shape. Yes, that is society's expectation, but it is a sort of jail. And so I love what you're saying, that there's freedom if you can't conform, there's actually freedom in that, because you can just be free to be who you are. Yeah. And without minimizing the strength and courage that it takes to do that, you know, mm-hmm. So that is, like Julie said, you obviously have that. You talked about your feminist approach and, you know, inspired by the Latinx women, but also what I heard, and so correct me if I'm wrong, but just the, your cultural tradition of things passing through the mother, like property passing through the mother, and just, you know, the kids passing through the mother. That sounds really interesting to me. And so I'd just love to learn about your approach to feminism and how that informs your work.
Yeah, so my approach to feminism, I love it. It has been centered on that, like, I don't fit within this idea and I don't want to because it's tiresome. So I'm just going to do my own thing. And I think that has been an important thing for me in finding other Black feminists who are there scholars who've written about that, who've either exemplified that in their activism, because it's been the ones that I've been drawn to the most. For me, I think it's important because societal expectations, particularly on Black women, like at the end of the day, it could kill us in what it tells us to do and how to be and how it terrorizes us at the same time. And so for me, my approach to feminism has always just been one centered on being your true authentic self and bringing in people with you at the same time, whether it was like from my like high school days of calling out administration for making decisions without consulting students, to my student activism and creating spaces in a campus where there's this assumption that's liberal, so everything's fine, but like really pushing on like the conversations we're having and making sure that people who were in like the sciences could also have access to talking about feminist scholarship and women's leadership, to even now in being sometimes the only Black woman face in tables talking about 2S LGBTQ issues. It's always just been this ability to just be myself, but also bring people along with me to be like, this is something that you can do. And it's been really exciting hearing from other people that from seeing my like zero S attitude that it's inspired them to make certain decisions. There's another Black Ghanaian girl who ironically our parents know each other. She's like, it's because of you that I actually came out to my parents. And I was like, really? She's like, yeah. She's like, you are just so you. And it's just like, what am I hiding? Like, what is the point of hiding from this? And so I really like that being that representation for other people, but I do really like leadership that is bold, and it's Black feminists who've done that for me. And it's something that I continue to do. And it's also centered on community. I, as much as I'm caring for myself, at the end of the day, there are other people whose either barriers that I'm destroying, representation, it's for other folks at the end of the day. And so to be a possibility model myself to other Black women, that's really important. And that's what keeps me going.
I love that. And the idea of the Black feminist theory, which you draw heavily from, just for our listeners, because this was like an education for me as well, but it was foreign because Black women's experience is so different from white women's, white feminists, right? And so Black women were not being represented or respected in you know, the feminist movement. And so how would you say that using this and working through this lens has changed the way, you know, the work around you is changing? So as you apply it and as you inform others, you know, are people learning? Are people grasping it? Do they realize that this is a really big issue in the world?
I hope so. I really hope so. Some people still don't get it, no matter how many times we say it politely or screaming out loud in the streets through a megaphone. I do think in the work that I'm in, which is like policy, but then human rights at the same time, I'm seeing that change the most, where we'll be talking about an issue related to, say, childcare. It isn't just a cisgender white woman who's middle class who's seeking childcare. There are Black lesbians with two mom families that need childcare, and that issue looks completely different when there isn't a man who socialized not to do like that type of labor at the household, or looking at it from the case of like women with disabilities. I think the conversations in those spaces are absolutely changing, where a lot of people realize that you cannot look at a social issue through that one singular lens that it only impacts through gender. There are other systems of oppression that come in, and that if you only look at it from as a single issue situation, you are missing, there's the blinders. And I think a lot of people who work in diversity and inclusion use that analogy. There are so many blinders, and you're not acknowledging who's being left behind, which is goes back to my feminist approach of like wanting to make sure that community is coming along with me. I never want to be in a situation where it's like, uh-oh, we forgot this very important issue because no one considered how these systems affect them. And so I see it there. I think where the most challenges are outside of the policy human rights space, where like business, for example, and operating in a capitalist society, even though they can paint, or I don't know, change their logo to be rainbow, et cetera, there's still so much work that needs to be done. And when you're not speaking to the already converted, I think it becomes a very interesting challenge. So imagine kind of explaining the importance of an intersectional framework to people who are running like Fortune 500 companies. It's complicated. So, but I think a lot more people are reminding people to take off those blinders. So you'll see people be like, where does an intersectionality lens come in when you pink wash with either a rainbow logo? Are you asking these particular questions? That part's difficult, but I definitely think the circle around me, we're definitely seeing more of that change.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think looking at you, you're a black woman, you're queer, your parents were newcomers to Canada. And so, you know, your personal experience has been touched by several different movements going on right now. And I'm wondering, are those movements intersecting and supporting each other enough in your view?
I think it's hard. That's hard to quantify. And I think that the lens that I have and the people around me, I think it's different. I think it'd be very interesting if I maybe wasn't working in the field that I'm in or not involved in the same social circles, because I do think, like I look at the Black Lives Matter movement, for example. If you look at Black Lives Matter organizing here in Canada, if you were to see who's at the front lines, it is usually Black women and it's usually queer and trans people who are at the front lines of that. And so by default of the people who are at the front lines coming from all of these different type of marginalities, I believe that that lens is coming at the forefront. Where I don't see that happening, I think, is where the messaging hits mainstream media. What happened in the murder of George Floyd, for example, a prime example of how when the institution of policing impacts Black people, the stories that we hear the most are men. Those are the stories that end up being at the forefront of news media and the news cycle. Oftentimes when it's Black women or specifically Black trans women whose murder rates are exceptionally high in the US and even here in Canada, those are the stories that people like myself in the community are sharing amongst each other, but those never hit mainstream media. But cisgender Black men, absolutely. So I do feel like there's this interesting duality where in the community we're seeing movements intersect. I'm seeing beautiful collaboration and solidarity amongst Black and Indigenous people, with queer folks all over the place. But once it's a story told and a narrative told to the broader public, it always resorts back to the single issue of it's Black men are the only ones who are impacted by police brutality. And once you, and it's like, no, once you start removing all the different layers, you end up seeing that other forms of marginality are impacting Black people differently, and that intersecting movements are the only time where we're actually pointing out that other things are happening to the most vulnerable in our community. So I definitely see that there's this duality. I'm fortunate enough to be around those who are at the front lines, so I never have to feel like all of the issues that impact me are missing. But if I were to turn on the television to CBC News, for example, you definitely feel that erasure. And I think that's where you see things are missing.
Well, you are at the front lines. You are the executive director of the Canadian Centre for Gender and Sexual Diversity, so CCGSD. I mean, I hadn't really heard about this organization before, and I'm sure most of our listeners or some of our listeners haven't as well. And so upon learning about it, this is a really important organization. And so can you tell us about its mission and some of your major initiatives?
Absolutely. So the CCGSD, or the Canadian Centre for Gender and Sexual Diversity, works to empower gender and sexually diverse people through advocacy, education, and research. And the main crux of what of the work that we do is through educational programming across the country, where we specifically like do deep dive on anti-discrimination and allyship. Some of our biggest initiatives and ones that I'm really, really proud of, especially since we have a youth focus, is our queer history program. Even in the context of COVID, we were able to reach, I think, 22,000 young people and students through a queer history program in schools across the country. And through shifting the way we teach and learn about people who aren't at the forefront, same thing going back to the narrative sharing, even in media, we see the same thing where certain stories are the ones that are prioritized, and that when you want to hear those diverse stories, you end up having to go to the community who's telling them from diverse perspectives. We recognize that education is a really important way of challenging and tackling discrimination. And so this queer history program has been really impactful in reaching these amount of young people. And I would say kudos to the teachers who, even in the context of COVID, of moving from virtual to in-class learning, have still prioritized equity in the classroom and have engaged with our resources. That has been really, really important. And I think another part of our work that we're really trying to redefine and strategize on now with my presence in the organization is our advocacy work. Oftentimes in 2S LGBTQ national spaces, the youth voice is almost always absent. And so to be that voice who's at the table, who's bringing attention back to the fact that now we know with recent stats, you know, 1/3 of the 2S LGBTQ population are youth. And so if we're ever going to talk about issues pertaining to our community, like homelessness, you have to have young people at the table. And so that is what we do. And I'm excited with a lot of the advocacy initiatives we're starting to take on. The work is super important. It's more important now than ever, especially with the rise of hate crimes, including the one recently in Toronto, that to the issues that people say were passed, that like, oh, you folks can vote now, everything's fine. We are still fighting. Mm-hmm. And some of the most marginalized in our community are still fighting for some of the most basic things like health, like healthcare access and affirming healthcare for trans folks. So that's what we do in a nutshell. It's exciting work, and I'm happy that I get to kind of lead it. It's really cool.
That's amazing work. And, you know, Julie and I, we have a lot of kids. We have 7 kids between the two of us. And I can't say I've fully been watching what they're doing online school because working at the same time. But I have heard some of the things they're learning. And the teachers really have made a good effort to, you know, talk about Indigenous issues and, you know, anti-Black racism and LGBTQIA+, like all that awesome stuff is really happening. And so that's amazing to hear that your organization is part of that, feeding information into the schools. But I imagine that not all schools are receptive to that. Like my children are at a public school. I went to a very Catholic school. So is it hard to get this out into some of the educational systems?
Absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned public school versus Catholic school, because I went to Catholic school my entire like grade school life. And I often tell the story from my perspective of the subliminal conditioning that happens when you never see yourself reflected in the curriculum. Mm-hmm. And it's even more startling to know that the stuff that I was learning in middle, like elementary school, and I graduated in 2006, is still being taught today. So there hasn't even been a shift within that school system to reflect, you know, queer and trans families as also being normal. And there are some awesome teacher advocates who have been like, showing the pages of textbooks being like, this is what we're still teaching. And like I mentioned, I'm 29. So for people who are 11 years old in grade 6 to still be learning what I learned back then, I think it's a little concerning, especially since 2006, different time. We're talking MySpace era, and now we're talking TikTok, right? And so the most, I would say it's also a reflection of the difficulty of us entering schools. And I won't even just say Catholic schools. Our biggest issue with doing the work within the classrooms has been adult decision makers. So whether that's administration or school boards, oftentimes what it presents is that teachers have to almost sneak us in a weird way, where they want to teach this, the students are asking for it, and so they have to kind of frame it with mm-hmm. fluffy language to get that approval from admin. But then once administration hears what we're going to teach, which is based on the curriculum that the province of Ontario or other provinces have said we can, then they'll say no. So there have been times where we've booked to go into a classroom and do a workshop and a principal has said no, or parents were concerned, so no. And that remains the biggest challenge. And I think if you look at some of the debates with regards to flying the flag in Catholic schools at the school board level, the prime example of the issue that is at hand, that even symbolic gestures like putting up a flag are not enough mm-hmm. because curriculums haven't evolved. And that is the main crux of the issue. Mm-hmm. And so adult decision makers, despite what students want, tend to be our biggest barrier to doing the work.
Mm. In the along the lines of education, I just want to get this right. 2SLGBTQ+, or do we say IAS? I just want to make sure, because you can, you see it differently in different areas. Even when we were researching for you, it was listed differently in a couple of different areas. So is it okay to just add the plus right after the Q, or do we say IA now?
It's a good question. You could ask a group of like 10 queer and trans people and they'll all say a different answer.
Okay.
So I think the acronym, it's fluid. So other people will say it a particular way. Other people will say it one way. I use 2SLGBTQ+, but I intentionally put 2S because of like my own personal commitment to reconciliation and wanting to spirit people to be at the mm-hmm. forefront of it. Mm-hmm. So I think when you see that, I think that's probably a really important thing to have. Mm-hmm. But I think the rest, can whatever order you prefer.
I love it. Okay. You say it so quickly too. I need to practice.
I know. I've got to read it to make sure that I'm saying it properly. Just because I don't use it that often, right? And I think that that's important to realize that maybe this needs to be more of a part of my vocabulary, right? But I wanted to just touch on the idea that gender-based violence is also affects the 2SLGBTQ+ community, but they're often left out of these discussions and also research and stats, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, it's more like violence against women. So, you know, how do we change that? How do we inform more? How do we bring in, you know, this entire group of people that are left out?
I love this question because I am a gender studies major for my undergrad, so I get to like nerd out a little. But I think it starts off like two ways. The first one, recognizing that gender in itself and how it's placed on people is it in itself is a form of limiting us with expectations and punishing people who fall out those expectations, and that homophobia and transphobia are violent reactions to people not performing the gender that they're supposed to be performing. Mm-hmm. So essentially, us being gendered as women, for example, or people automatically being gendered as men, that comes with a set of attributes or characteristics that we have to perform. And through that type of conditioning, like some people question, why is that a thing? And it's something that we take for granted. We just think that gender is like, well, you were born with a particular sex, so here's some pink, go on with your life. And for me, it goes back to questioning, what is it about being born with a particular type of genitalia that then says this person is destined for this particular life, these particular expectations, even down to the type of work they're going to do. And that people resist it in various ways because, and I've mentioned this in my own case, being a woman, the expectation in my community that I have to be with a man. And that comes with that heteronormativity. And so in not doing that, homophobia is something that is a particular type of violence that's impacted upon me, similar like misogyny, both at the same time in my case. And that's when I'll deal with either discrimination or violence that's either verbal and sometimes physical. And I think it's important if we're going to have a nuanced conversation on gender-based violence is that violence looks like so many different things depending on the level of identities that you have, and that we cannot treat me being a queer woman as just like I always use the joke, it's not a Google Chrome extension. Like, I am a queer Black woman at all at the same time. And in trying to treat it as an additional thing, you're really ignoring the very systematic reality that homophobia has on my life. Being a woman who is resisting the expectation of being with a man, and it comes with violences. And even in my home country recently, there was a masculine lesbian woman. She was subjected to corrective rape, which is a practice that's done across the world, even in Canada, to correct her gender performance and her sexuality. And for me, I think it's just super important that we see homophobia and transphobia for what it is, so that the right public policy approaches to address them are there. Otherwise, we're back to the same cyclical thing of like, oh, well, everyone's included. There are rainbows. Everything's fine. And it's just like, no, because we still live in a society that treats people a particular way and punishes them in these particular ways. And you're trying to ignore it. And that's not the case. And so for me, especially in the advocacy work that I'm doing with the federal government, having homophobia and transphobia be seen as gender-based violence means that the right finance will go towards it, the right policy attention will go towards it, so that our communities can live fulfilling lives without discrimination or violence.
I just want to clarify this homophobia, transphobia, because the word itself makes it sound like you're so scared of a queer person that you're like running away from them. And that's not necessarily what homophobia is. And in my own experience, I have teenage children, and my 16-year-old daughter, she's actually very big social activist in every area, right? A lot of the kids are now, because everything is on Instagram and they see it and they're like, fight for the rights. And, you know, we had a conversation because some of her friends are, you know, coming out as bisexual, or, and I said it, you know, and this was my own ignorance. Just in passing, I was like, well, it sounds like it's kind of like trendy to be this way right now, right? Like, all the kids are kind of coming out, and is it, you know, get attention seeking or whatever? My daughter was like, Mom, that is the most ignorant thing that you could have said. The reason is, and it's how you put it, is that gender is this form of limiting belief that society has put on us. And we, as a younger generation, are finally not conforming to it. And I was like, foot in mouth, like, I felt like I had been taught. And so it actually really was understanding that I don't have to be scared. I can be completely accepting of, gay people, queer people, like, but still have these ideas that are so ingrained in me. That is a part of what homophobia is, and what kind of constricts us from being open and learning.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you're not the only person who's may have used similar phrasing of like, oh, it seems trendy. Mm. I think that response is an interesting one, because it always goes back to this idea that like, it's a not a choice, but like, when something's trendy, think of like even clothing, it's just like, oh, it's cool now. And then it'll stop being cool. So then at some point people will stop like coming out as being bi or whatever. I think your daughter, it was your daughter, am I correct?
It was my daughter, yeah.
Yeah, I think she hit the nail on the head there in really explaining that, and this is how I see it, the work that our queer and trans elders in generations before, we are seeing the results of that work with Gen Z. We're seeing the result of the work of chipping away of expectations that you have to be straight, or you have to fit within this idea of like, gender, that it's the one that you were assigned at birth. And I think for me, it's I'm in tears almost sometimes seeing that is what people have been fighting for, that younger generations do not have to feel boxed. And I think for a 16-year-old to have that answer, I'm like, yes, it's just awesome.
It's like a learning opportunity, but also I was so proud of her, because I was like, okay, like, this is what I need to learn and how I can become better. But she's already there. Like, it was so impressive.
Yeah, it's awesome. And it's also awesome because even for myself, who graduated from high school 11 years ago, there a lot of us weren't, you know, coming out in high school just because we didn't want to be bothered with it. But now there are people who, even before they hit grade 9, already have the vocabulary, the knowledge, and an idea of who they are. And I think it's just a testament to the changes that have happened in society. Like the work that my organization does is it's cultural work. We're changing culture for the long term. And so we're seeing those shifts happen, which I think is awesome. And I think we're seeing empowerment as opposed to people like doing things trendy.
Can you speak a little bit more about, I mean, everything you're talking about now is about, you know, gender conditioning and pushing that aside and also pushing aside this heteronormative type of, you know, expectation on society. But then there's also research. When we looked at your site, there's research and science that actually dispels this whole binary view of gender too. And so I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit more about the issues that affect intersex people in your community, and as well, whether that is similar or different than the two-spirit. I'm curious about that.
Absolutely. So I'll definitely contextualize that I'm approaching this response to this question as someone who's cisgender. So I identify with the gender that was assigned to me at birth. And so I'm speaking on this as like someone who, or I wouldn't even say considers themselves an ally, is striving to be an ally towards intersex and two-spirit people. For intersex people in particular, and it's so interesting how even gender conditioning is done even through the state, even as soon as you're born. You probably would have seen in either the research or even some narratives that, if I'm correct, there's regulation by the state that when a child is born, there has to be a designation on their birth certificate. And usually whomever the doctor is, the midwife, whomever, you look at the baby's genitals, you're like, all right, MRF. In some cases, it is not that easy to determine. And this is not just like one-off. There's a significant portion of the world's population, and I do not have the total, like the percentage top of mind, but there are a considerable amount of people who are born with either ambiguous genitalia or with other forms of secondary sex characteristics, whether it's their external genitals might look like a penis, but they have a uterus, or their hormones are different levels. And I think it is a testament to showing that, and even in trying to box sex, so the physical characteristics is problematic because there are people who do not even exist within those two boxes we try to put them in. And I think it's important. There's a level of importance in making sure that intersex people have a voice within our community. But I will also point out the fact that our community has done, and I'm not congratulating it, we've done a great job at even erasing intersex people and their issues. And I think their issues are super important because they call out the flaw of our state in trying to regulate who is who as soon as they're born. And they've completely changed the way even like medical approaches to people of different genders, et cetera. That is super important work. And I'm really glad that there are some awesome activists who are pointing out issues there. But where it's different from two-spirit folks, for example, two-spiritness it's an English term that was coined not that long ago, specifically to speak to Indigenous people here in Turtle Island who, I don't want to say are also queer and trans because that is different. It's a different term to name the traditional experiences of people who don't fall within the traditional male-female binary. And I think it is a reclaiming term because through Canadian colonization, those identities have been erased because they don't fit within the expectation of male-female. Very similarly in Ghana, gender as we know it, or modern concepts of gender were also introduced through colonization. And so they're different in that with intersex people, we're looking at secondary sex characteristics, where two-spirit folks were looking at the reclaiming of identities that were lost through colonization.
Okay, beautiful, thank you.
This is a really an amazing time right now. It's Pride Month, and you know, we are seeing so much and there's more access and we're learning more about, you know, pride and what it means. And you were quoted as saying that pride means liberation and resistance. It means disrupting the status quo and just existing and taking up space. Pride is Black, it is feminist, and it is radical. Pride is everything. It's such a strong and beautiful statement. Can you tell us how it makes you feel when you think about pride?
When I think about pride, I think of home, to be completely honest with you. I think of that feeling you get, those butterflies where you're going back home for the first time in a long time. It just feels like that. There's this level of warmth, safety, and comfort when I think of pride. And I often go back to images I had as a child going to pride, to dyke marches where I was seeing possibility around me. And when I think of not only the month of pride as home, I also think of like the ability to bring people together that it has. Obviously different in this context in COVID-19, but in a pre-COVID-19 world, pride has always felt like home. I always felt happiness and nostalgia just being around people who are like me, but also so different from me at the same time. And we're all there for the same reason of celebrating our resistance as people, our existence of people, and the fact that we're still here is a beautiful testament, again, to the work of awesome people who've been fighting for queer and trans rights around the world. So I would definitely say it just feels like home.
I love that. I love that. The safety, right, to be who you are and to celebrate that. We're wondering how you support yourself in doing this work that you do, and you show up and you seem so positive and strong, but we imagine that there's challenges in that. And, you know, the vision of the CCGSD is to create a world without discrimination, a world in which people can shape the decisions that impact their lives, enjoy freedoms, and navigate an equal world free of violence. And we're not in that world yet. So how do you navigate and support yourself through the tension of working towards this world, but dealing with the one we currently have?
I love that question, because I think oftentimes people who are doing this type of work, and I often think of like frontline workers who work in women's shelters, for example, like we show up every day to change the world around us. And sometimes we're also impacted by either the violences that our work is addressing or that our mission is speaking towards. And oftentimes it means you have to read, see, advocate, sit on tables with people who wish you didn't exist. And that is exhausting mentally. And I would also say spiritually, and it's not a surprise that a lot of people in this work burn out and then they leave. For me, especially before I joined CCGSD, I knew that I did not want to burn out, because I think showing up for the community in the way that I do is super important, but also self-preservation is important. And that is a beautiful quote from Audre Lorde about the importance of self-preservation, not being selfish. In order to do that, I had to surround myself with mentors, and I would say a great cheerleading squad whom I could go to when things are tough. And so whether it's my partner or a mentor of mine who's another Black woman who's an ED here in Ottawa, or the Black ED network that I created here in Ottawa, where we can kind of just get together and vent and rant. It was through creating that cheerleading group so that when I am feeling the most emotions that I will deal with because something was said or I read with something, I know that there are people who are around me who also get it, who understand it, because it's stuff that they're also seeing in this work. And then we're doing this reciprocal care work for each other. Sometimes it also includes just shutting off. Like I need to shut off that activist-y part of my brain. And honestly, this might sound like silly and trivial, making earrings. I make earrings, including
these.
Did
you make those? Those are beautiful.
Thank you.
For our listeners, you're wearing these beautiful watermelon earrings.
Yeah, whether it's like earrings or just like playing video games. And I never was a gamer before, but I found myself just in order to kind of escape a little bit from the real world, kind of just doing these activities where I'm either creating something or playing with something. And that has been really good for me. The other part is like also get a good therapist, like that too. But I definitely say community and just an escape through creation.
Yeah, beautiful. I love that you know, we've talked to other creatives out there who use creativity to spawn more creativity. And so, you know, even though you might not think of your role as creative, there is a lot of that creativity that comes into it. And so just sort of decompressing and giving yourself that time. We, you know, have so many questions for you that we wanted to touch on and, you know, just get your perspective. And we're already at the place where we ask the question, what is your afterglow? And so your afterglow is, you know, what's next for you? What's your, you know, dream for the future? It's, you know, what have you, what are you planning on doing now that you're going to listen to your own self instead of others, which you've already done that part. So maybe it's like, what's your next afterglow for you? And it can be for yourself or the world.
It's a beautiful question. That's a very, very, very beautiful question. I think my afterglow, still related to the work that we do, but also connected to my home country, I think my afterglow is to play a bigger role in supporting queer and trans rights in Ghana. Mm. There's been some interesting news, especially at the beginning of the year, with the forced closure of the only LGBTQ resource center in Accra. And seeing not only the activism of like queer and trans siblings in my home country playing a role in making sure people here in Canada knew what was happening, but then also being in awe of their like courageousness and their resiliency. There's, I think personally, there's a lot that queer and trans activists in the West can learn from those who are doing the same work in the global South, who are a constantly at threat by the state. There's a lot of work there. And I think in the future, my afterglow, not only do I want to see my country ridding itself of old colonial law so queer and trans people could just be free, I also want to support that in some way. Mm. So I don't know what that'll look like, but I definitely see myself doing that. I think it's important.
That's beautiful. It sounds like a full circle, right?
Yeah.
Coming from a full circle. Yeah. You know, one last question here. What would you say to our listeners who, I'm guessing, we don't have official statistics, but I'm guessing largely cisgender, hetero, you know, what would you say to this audience in terms of how they could support you? What are some things they could do, some practical steps they could take to support your work and your movement?
Yeah. So I think there are a few. I think I would definitely encourage people to either follow the work of the Canadian Centre for Gender and Sexual Diversity, whether it's on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. If you are someone who cares to donate after Pride Month, if that's something that we always like to say, you're so welcome to donating to our organization, like through donation supports. We're able to increase our capacity and reach more trans LGBTQ youth, especially in rural areas who are like desperate for that type of work. But I would also say to the listeners to also to do the work themselves, like definitely look at either the resources that we have on our website or the resources of other LGBTQ organizations, including maybe the local ones that are in the city or the town that you live in. You could benefit from constantly being a learner. Like the learning will never end, right? And so always, I think, if you think of it that way, to always be a learner, you'll constantly be in this practice of allyship if that's something you're striving towards. And so I would definitely encourage people to seek out that knowledge. And it's closer to home than you think. There are some amazing local like queer and trans organizations, and you should like check them out, support them at the same time.
I love the idea of that queer history program that you were talking about. I was like, oh, I would actually like really like to take that and learn about that. I mean, there's so much, particularly for our ages. Liz and I are, you know, upper 40s. Well, I'm upper 40s, but that, you know, we just didn't have access to. We didn't have the knowledge about. We didn't have information. It wasn't even talked about when we were growing up. And so now that would be, you know, just something, like you said, is just to kind of keep learning. And there's so much to learn about. And I love how you have been so open in this conversation and sharing your experience with us and your wisdom. And the one thing that I've really gained from it is your concept of possibility. And I love that. And it's really sort of, I think it is an invitation as opposed to, you know, pushing somebody away. It really is an invitation to ask all of us to come and be a part of what's possible and see what the possibilities are. So thank you so much for providing that for us.
Thank you. And thanks so much for having me.
I just want to echo what Julie said, and that I'm really just feeling generosity and grace from you is what I feel.
Thank you.
Yeah, those two words. That's how you show up, and that's how I feel. And you make me want to learn more, and you know, and do better. So really, thank you for your time today. It was really lovely to meet you.
It's really lovely to meet both of you, Julie and Liz. I really appreciate it, and I'd love the opportunity to chat. It was awesome.
This is just a reminder to let you know that the Richards Group, located in the Toronto Beaches area, is working really hard right now to make sure that everything is set up for your moving needs. So if you're looking for an agent that encompasses everything, look no further than the Richards Group.
That's a wrap for this episode of The Afterglow. Yet another courageous Canadian sharing her vision.
Do us a favor and lift a sister up by sharing this podcast with others who want to find their afterglow. And let us know, what do you want to hear about? Who do you want to hear from? And what is your afterglow? Slide on into our DMs at The Afterglow Podcast Official and leave us a message.
Did you love this podcast? Be sure to like and rate us on Spotify and iTunes and wherever you tune in. Until next time.